Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Well, Kentucky's doctors are worried. There's COVID-19, of course, but since the coronavirus pandemic was officially declared back in March, something else has happened. A big drop in child vaccinations against other diseases like measles, mumps, diphtheria, hepatitis. Dr. Dale Toney, a Lexington internist, is the new president of the Kentucky Medical Association. Dr. Toney, let's begin with Raise Your Guard, the multimedia campaign that came to our attention here at WEKU. What's this about?
Well, thanks, Tom. What this is, it's a raiseyourguard.ky. It's a campaign that encourages Kentuckians to schedule well visits with their physicians or providers and to update their vaccinations. And all that, of course, helps them be optimal with their health.
And how is this campaign funded?
Well, it is funded jointly and sponsored jointly from the Kentucky Medical Association, the Kentucky Foundation for Medical Care, the Foundation for a Healthy Kentucky, and also Anthem, Blue Cross, and Blue Shield in Kentucky. And they've all provided funding and are sponsors of this program.
Okay, let's get to the facts that are driving this public awareness campaign. If you would, tell us what's been happening with regard to vaccinations in Kentucky in the weeks and the months since March, when COVID-19 was declared a national emergency.
Well, you're exactly right. When COVID-19 hit in March, everything shut down, including health facilities. So physician offices, health departments, things just shut down. And just emergencies were taken care of for the first month, probably first 6 weeks. And so people weren't going to their physicians or their providers and weren't getting vaccines. And the vaccine rates went down. Nationwide data from the CDC, the vaccine order rate was lower compared to just the month before. And that's, of course, an indication that the vaccines were given at a slower rate because of the COVID crisis. In Kentucky, the same thing happened. In fact, Medicaid has some data for the 4 months of March through June of this year. And for children up to the age of two, the rate of 2020 for those 4 months was 28% lower than the same 4 months in 2019. So that was for children up to the age of two. And then for children between the ages of four and six, that rate was down 46% compared to the previous year. And then for adolescents, the rate was down 57% compared to the same time period in 2019. Again, this was Medicaid data for those 4 months compared to this year, compared to last year.
Those seem like mighty big numbers. Why should we be concerned about them?
Well, it puts people at risk. You know, vaccinations prevent infectious diseases that are preventable with vaccines. And of course, that's what we love to do, is prevent things. When I tell my patients that, like, you wear your seatbelt to prevent injury from a car wreck. And so it's prevention. We'd rather prevent things. So, but the decline is also worrisome, because if you don't have enough people vaccinated, it may prevent the herd immunity, which is a good thing to have. And of course, we're all worried as we're approaching flu season. And I think flu shots are just now I'm hearing some on the news that they're just now starting to be available, that we're afraid that that may affect that as well. And of course, eventually, there'll be a COVID vaccine as well. And so that will be important to get that as well. But speaking of flu and COVID and getting the flu shot, because remember, when a person gets flu symptoms, they're going to be so similar to COVID. And when it first happens, we're not going to know which one it is, flu or COVID. So that's going to be an issue. So absolutely get the flu shot.
You mentioned herd immunity. And we're talking about, besides COVID-19 and flu, we're talking about things like measles, mumps, and hepatitis, those kinds of disease that had seemed to be eradicated or very rare in the past. Is that not necessarily the case today?
Well, I think it is still the case. And of course, herd immunity is a good thing. You have to, if enough people get vaccinated, and I think that rate's at 95%. So if enough people get vaccinated for a particular infectious condition, then there's not enough of that condition, like mumps or measles, to infect that other portion of the population that didn't get their shot. So, and again, it's 95% is what that is. So if 95% will get the shot of whatever infection it is, then there's not enough of the infection to infect the people that didn't get the shots or that are maybe susceptible because they're immunocompromised or for some other reason. So that's what we mean by herd immunity, and that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Are you able to tell from the data that you have on hand if these declines in vaccinations are concentrated or clustered in any particular areas of the state?
Yes, it tends to be more affecting the rural population. So it affects the rural population more, but it affects everybody in Kentucky, but the rural population more. So this campaign that we're doing will be targeted a little more in the rural counties for that very reason.
Mm-hmm. Well, taking this decline in vaccinations into consideration, do you have concerns about reopening schools to in-person instruction? And we're not talking about necessarily COVID-19 here, but additional diseases.
Well, I don't guess I'm really at a position to make a decision about reopening schools, but I do think that schools probably that decision needs to consider vaccination rates to make that decision. But I certainly can't really comment about the actual opening of the schools.
Mm-hmm. There have been a number of national polls out there that have been finding roughly one-third of Americans are saying that they will not be vaccinated against COVID-19, at least not in the first round. And there seems to be a lot of confusion around the safety and efficacy of vaccinations in general. And as a medical professional, what can you say to people who are uncertain or reluctant to be vaccinated?
Oh, great, great question, Tom. Vaccines are effective. Vaccines are safe. In the U.S. especially, the FDA, you just can't say enough good things about the FDA. They are studied and they're not released until they're are proven to work. And I think once the FDA approves it, it will be safe to do it. And there's phase 3 trials going on across the U.S. and that's the phase 4 is the final phase. And phase 3 trials is where there's like 30,000 people that get the shots. And then they list the side effects and issues. And that's sort of where we are. And the FDA is expedited the COVID vaccine. So I certainly will get it once the FDA has approved it. Then we will certainly want people to get it to try to create this herd immunity that we were talking about a minute ago.
Are you able to comment on how vaccinations tie into the well-being of the economy?
Well, look at the crisis we are currently in, this COVID-19. Of course, there hasn't been a vaccine for it so far. Hopefully there will be soon, like we were just talking about. But it just crippled the economy in the U.S. And outbreaks will do that. So a healthy workforce will lead to a healthy economy. So if the workers are healthy, then the economy will flow.
Dr. Dale Tony of the Kentucky Medical Association. Thank you so much, Dr. Tony.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
We're checking in with teachers and superintendents in school districts in central and eastern Kentucky to see how they're dealing with the curveballs pitched at them by the pandemic. Tanya May is co-host of our series, Reopening Kentucky Schools.
Today we have joining us Dr. Diane Hatchett. She is the superintendent of the Berea Independent School System. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Hatchett, and taking part in our Reopening Kentucky Schools series.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Will you begin today by providing our listening audience a little background information on the Berea Independent School System?
We have about 1,100 students. We have a diverse community, about 18% minority at the elementary, middle, and high, each level. We have approximately 73% of our students are free and reduced lunch. We take pride in being a family. I mean, we don't call ourselves Berea Community School for nothing. I mean, we truly are very close-knit community, very supportive of one another. All of our kids get the opportunity to participate in sports or band, chorus, because we are a small school. We do really well on our ACT scores. We've been ranked around the top 20. We take pride in that. The sky's the limit for us.
That's wonderful. I love those high expectations, and it's so important to have that truly family and community feel. So I'm sure that's been very much a part of your success there at Berea Independent. Before we start talking about the fall reopening plan, can you tell us a little bit about the most significant challenges your district faced when schools closed unexpectedly this past March?
Actually, it was a short turnaround. I mean, the governor called all the superintendents in and told us to be ready within 72 hours. We could be notified that, you know, he would like for all of us to basically shut down and go to NTI. And so we pulled it together. I mean, our staff, I have hats off to every single teacher and staff member in our district. I mean, basically that Thursday, they got the word. Friday, we weren't going to be in school. So it was like all hands on deck. And we got those packets out and got the kids what they needed to get started. And then, of course, they changed it. I mean, we had, before it was said and done, over 16 different NTI guidances from KDE during that short period of time. So it was constantly something else coming out new, and our teachers would have to adjust. They did remarkably well. I feel like we did a great job checking in with our students every week after spring break. Everybody was checking in on their kids, not just during their packets, but like making personal phone calls, whether or not you were online or if you had a packet, you were still receiving that contact. And our families really appreciated. There were also like helpful hints that went out to help people. There were videos that were made. Our teachers did all kinds of things. They even had a reverse parade. And so the challenges was just keeping that momentum going, keeping the enthusiasm, keeping everybody focused and engaged, even though it was a totally different feel, because there were so many unknowns. You know, when are we going back to school? How long is this going to last? Getting the different constant guidance from KDE, you know, in attempts to support us. And the other challenge was feeding our kids. That very first weekend, I mean, when we knew we weren't going to be in school, because we're so high free and reduced lunch, the idea of our kids not having a meal was like something that would be incomprehensible. That was a huge challenge. We wanted to make sure from the very beginning that our kids were going to be able to eat every day and they were going to be able to have those meals. And so we partnered with Berea Kids Eat, and I can't say enough for them. We also worked closely with Madison County Schools. You know, both of our districts, it didn't matter to either one of us, you know, whichever kids came through the line, whether they went to Madison County or Berea, either one, both districts were going to feed the kids. So, I mean, we all worked together.
So what have some of been the major challenges your district has encountered in creating a fall reopening plan?
Well, right now, what we're working on is, well, one of the challenges originally that we had last year was, and going into this year, right now we're going to be 1-to-1, which is huge for us. Last year we were not 1-to-1, so that was another challenge that we had to overcome, because we had at least 90 families that did not have internet access. And so that, even though we're going to go 1-to-1 this year, that is still a challenge, because there's always somebody that doesn't have internet. And so just being able, first of all, to get those Chromebooks out into students' hands, and we have a plan. We're going to do a drive-through, you know, where they can pick up, and they're going to have like four different stations that they can go to. And we've got those details worked out. But getting those out, making sure people know how to operate Chromebooks, because just because you have a Chromebook in your hand doesn't mean maybe there's a grandparent or somebody who's never used a device like that, and or a parent with a small child at home, and that child can't do it. Now, for our older kids, yeah, they could probably do it in their sleep. But knowing, you know, how to operate it, how to get onto Google Classroom and things of that nature, that's a challenge for us. And just making sure we get everything handed out, making sure we get materials, getting our list, forms for enrollment, things of that nature, getting an agreement signed for Chromebook use, and just day-to-day things. Like, we also have White House Clinic on site. And so making sure we get that paperwork back, so that if families need like counseling or things of that nature, those forms are already returned, you know. So just getting that necessary things that all schools deal with at the beginning of school to get things handed out and back in, it's even more of a challenge in COVID because you don't see them every day, you know. So they have to come through the line, making sure we get our kids fed. You know, we're going to continue to feed our kids, whether we're in school, in person, or not in person. You know, they still have to meet those basic needs. So that's always going to be a challenge for us, trying to make sure that we can connect with the families and bring them in, the ones who don't have the internet access. So partnering with communities, looking at different partners. We're blessed to partner with the city, and they help us a lot. And just we have so many partners throughout the community that we team up with. And so connecting with those folks to see if we can get Wi-Fi access or other services for our students is always something we're looking at.
Is your district considering one or multiple reopening plans? Is it fully virtual at this point? Can you talk us through and explain your current plan?
Well, right now, our plan is, they had two options. There's the virtual learning with support services, and then there's independent learning. The independent learning is like self-paced, it's an application process. And so there's a lot, it's very deep. You know, a person has to be like very much a self-starter. And it's not an option that's recommended for students who need a lot of direct instruction or support services. Because basically what happens with that service is that there's weekly, you know, participation, of course. It's self-paced learning assignments. And assignments in each subject area, there's going to be an assessment at the end of each learning cycle. Weekly check-ins with school staff, but it's like they don't check in every day. You know, like maybe once a week they're checking in. So that is the independent version of it. There's, of course, you know, you don't need any transportation or anything like that. But for the other virtual option, that's when, you know, all of our students are going to begin virtually, whether they're, you know, no matter what. But we will have some on-site services for students, even with the virtual option, because remember I was telling you, some kids don't have internet service. And so we have to figure out a way to meet all kids' needs. And so maybe some parents would rather have them come into the building. Once again, application, it's not like you can just walk in, because we're going to phase that in. That's not something they're going to do day one. That would be like when we know it's safe, maybe after the first 2 weeks in school, we'll have like certain groups of kids in, like small groups of students on an as-needed basis. And so it will, services and the activities, they're going to be provided by appointment only, because we want to be able to control that setting. We want to make sure that everything is safe for our kids. We don't want to take any chances. You know, COVID is, you know, you can't see it. It's like that unknown entity. Maybe there's special needs students that need testing. Well, they need to be on site for the testing, so we would do that. Maybe they need remediation. Maybe they just need that small group where they can physically, maybe due to the nature of what their services require, they need to be with the teacher. And so those students, you know, we would set it up so that they would be there. There are students who need internet access. They're still online. They're just in the building and spread out, you know, or maybe like I said, there is something that for whatever, maybe there's a lab that we need to do. We would have kids maybe schedule a chemistry. They have what they need to come in. But we're going to be real creative. We have this bus at the mobile classroom. And so we're at the elementary level. We're going to be taking that bus out and going to different neighborhoods and doing like a lab, going by where kids can use what they have at home. So there's going to be like project based, and they can use things in their kitchen or things around the house to do the labs. And we'll have like a teacher and some teachers that are going around to the neighborhoods. So that way kids can still do the science, but they don't have to worry about coming into the school. Safety is always going to be our number one priority. So the services that we have on site is going to vary, and it's going to depend on the level of safety concerns, and they could be suspended at any time. Basically, you know, our leadership is going to continuously monitor the state of the learning environment to determine if changes are needed. And so other than that, everything is virtual. Like we're blessed to have Summit Learning for our middle and high school students. And so that's a really deep dive for our kids. They can, once again, work at their own pace, but they will have mentors with their teachers. They'll also have that daily interaction with their teachers. And so that is what we're doing at the middle and high school level. At the elementary level, we're using iReady, Google Classroom. Of course, we're going to have Google Classroom also at middle and high. But, you know, we're trying to do direct instruction. Mm-hmm. It may or may not be limited to video conferencing, video lessons. We are very innovative. And of course, we're also at the secondary level going to also have experiences for our kids at the college level, because, you know, we try to do whatever we can to keep that going as well.
Can you tell me, what do you think are a couple of the most important lessons that have been learned in your district from this situation that will make you stronger going forward?
Well, we've always tried to look for opportunities for our kids. But I think one of the most important lessons is, we're always stressed relationships, but I feel like in COVID, relationships are the need to reach out, because people feel so isolated, is even more important. So just having that personal connection, just checking in, was like the way we looked at it. It was important for like me as superintendent to check in with district staff to check in with the principals, and we all check in with each other at the district level, and then at the school level, making sure we're checking in on the teachers. Teachers are checking in on their kids. It's like everybody's checking on each other, you know, and then making sure that our families know that we're there for them. You know, like we just lost a very dear part of the Berea community's family. One of our teachers passed, and sending out that letter today, you know, that's going to be a tremendous thing, impact on our reopening, because she had been there for so long and was so much a part of who we are. And so just recognizing the emotional impact for our adults, as well as for our students and our family. And so just having that and realizing how important the wellness factor is.
Yes.
You know, that to me is a huge lesson that we never lose sight of. Always say Maslow before Bloom. You have to hit that before you can get to learning.
Yes.
No matter what. And so just checking in, checking connect with our kids, checking connect with our adults, and making sure everybody's okay. Because you can't expect anybody to learn anything if you don't have those basic needs. So it's the emotional part, it's the food, the safety, just being all well-rounded. To me, that's just how I see it.
Well, thank you once again for joining us today. We wish your students and your district much success in the upcoming year. And again, thank you for all your work on behalf of students in our state.
Well, thank you. Stay healthy.
You too.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
Change has come to a historic place in downtown Lexington that has haunted many for generations. Cheapside Park, at one time the site of slave auctions, is being renamed Henry Tandy Centennial Park. WEKU's Stu Johnson has more.
Even during a time when there's less moving about almost everywhere, Lexington's Cheapside Park, adjacent to the historic courthouse, exhibits a gathering place feel. And historical accounts tell us it was a bustling location in the pre-Civil War era. Yvonne Giles undertook family genealogy 21 years ago, and that led to an interest in African-American cemeteries and black residents' life in Lexington. Giles has served as a consultant for the International Museum of the Horse, conducted bus and walking tours, and worked with students of all ages. She says there were some 24 slave dealers in Lexington. In the 1800s, Giles says rural citizens would come downtown monthly to conduct government transactions and bring items to sell.
Anything that needed to be sold was sold at the courthouse. And of course, enslaved people were considered property at the time. So if you had enslaved people you wanted to sell, you could bring them to court day and actually sell them, just like you did your horses and cows and so forth.
Giles said Cheapside, being mentioned as one of the largest slave markets in the South, could be open to interpretation. She says references to thousands of slaves being sold is undocumented.
Now, I'm not taking away from the fact that Lexington was a large slave trading market, but it's because most of the dealers are based in Lexington. It did not mean that all of those individuals came off the auction block at Cheapside.
Lexington History Museum President Foster Ackerman says cheap in the old English vernacular meant to purchase and didn't carry the shoddy connotation. Ackerman says by and large the sales that happened on Cheapside were court-ordered. He said the foreclosure and sale of houses and livestock came following a cholera epidemic in 1833, and that's when reportedly the slave trade took off.
And unfortunately, but it was the time, slaves were property. There is a statute that said a slave was treated as real estate for purposes of probate law. So if a man died and there wasn't enough cash in his estate to pay all of his debts, his property was sold.
There's been a coordinated effort to address issues related to the Cheapside area in recent years. Lexington radio host and musician DeBron Thomas and local rapper Russell Allen met at a house party and formed the Take Back Cheapside group. It was instrumental in persuading the city to remove two Confederate statues from the historic courthouse grounds in the fall of 2017. Regarding slave trade there, Thomas says Take Back Cheapside is seeking a public apology from local government officials for what occurred in the courthouse following a sale. Thomas moved from Northern California to Lexington to attend at the University of Kentucky and then became a Central Kentucky resident. He says he and Allen have also gone to the city urging a redesign of the downtown park.
Working to make this space a place that people actually want to come to, particularly black people and other people of color, because a lot of the things that and events that have happened here aren't necessarily all that inclusive. And changing the name, again, as I said, isn't going to automatically just make people want to come here.
Thomas cited Thursday Night Live before COVID-19 as an example of a seasonal gathering with musical entertainment as an event that didn't attract a significantly diverse crowd at the park. The local musician and racial justice activist says it's fitting the park from now on be called the Henry Tandy Centennial Park. Thomas says the former slave, who became a successful businessman in masonry work, made an impact in different parts of town. He says not only did workers at the masonry firm co-owned by Tandy build a brick foundation for the town's fourth courthouse, but Tandy also helped lead development in the East End. A wall exhibit telling the Henry Tandy story now greets visitors who enter the fully refurbished historic Lexington courthouse. Mary Quinn Raymer is president of Visit Lex, whose office is inside the reinvented building.
There's no doubt that Mr. Tandy and his company's work and their craftsmanship have, created a building that 100 years later is clearly one of the iconic buildings of our city. So they did tremendous work.
Raymer says there's synergy between Visit Lex, a key player in promoting the city of Lexington, and the park. A string of businesses line one side of the park. Nate Pauley, a Lexington native, owns Nate's Coffee Shop. He calls the name change a step in the right direction in fixing a situation that a lot of people are unhappy about. Pauley says the name change is fine, but hopefully it won't mean changing any business addresses.
Which is very important, because there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 bars here that all would have to get relicensed by the ABC if they change their address. So that's, would be a huge hit to their financial well-being if they had to reapply for an address change or a name change.
Raya Rivera pushed a stroller down Short Street recently. After being stopped, she said she came to Lexington from Philadelphia to attend UK. Like DeBron Thomas, she stayed and has called Lexington home for 7 years. She was asked if changing the name of Cheapside Park could help race relations.
I hope it would put that in the right direction, put that whole movement in place. Names are powerful, though, and words are powerful, and so maybe.
For his part, Thomas says he's seeing more and more people being open to conversation about issues of race. That conversation is likely to continue. I'm Stu Johnson in Lexington.
Coming up after the break, Silas House on changes he's noticing as people adjust to the pandemic.
I think a lot of people would sometimes spend their evenings on their laptops or on their phones or now out going for walks and sitting on the porch.
And what do drag racing and the Kentucky Derby have in common? Stick around to find out. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Getting to pick people's brains about all kinds of things is one of the joys of producing Eastern Standard. As host of our series Future Tense, Chris Begley is tapping into the minds of people who do a lot of thinking for a living to get their takes on life in this pandemic and whether or how it's changing things.
Well, I'm very excited today to welcome Silas House to Future Tense. Silas is a professor and chair of Appalachian Studies at Berea College and one of the major writers of the American South, a novelist whose best-selling and award-winning works include Clay's Quilt, Cole Tattoo, and the recent Southernmost. He's also published nonfiction in a variety of forms, including a book profiling folks fighting against mountaintop removal, that with Jason Howard. Welcome, Silas.
Thank you, Chris. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I want to talk about where we find ourselves now during the pandemic and a little bit of how the kinds of things that you write about and think about come out, perhaps in the sort of the real world that we find ourselves in. In a recent piece in The Atlantic, and also in your novels, you talk about community lost, community found in different ways. I wanted to ask how that concept has changed for you. Has your appreciation of it or definition of it changed in the midst of everything we're going through?
Well, I think one reason I'm a writer is because I grew up in such a vibrant community, meaning there were always people around and they were always telling stories. You know, it seemed like that our house was sort of one of the centers of the community. There were always a bunch of people on the porch. You know, my aunt ran a little store that was sort of a community center, and I was often there. So I think I soaked up so many of those stories. It's one reason I became a writer. And of course, the loss of community is one thing I've thought so much about during the pandemic. What I wrote about for The Atlantic was when they asked me, you know, what my main concern was right now, I was so glad to see the way people were keeping community alive. And so I wrote about that, and the piece is meant to also encourage us to do that. So, I mean, even though we aren't able to visit each other in the same way or go out together or all that, I do love the way that people have found ways to still be together.
What's an example of some of those ways that you've enjoyed?
Well, you know, I mean, I have always seen the pros and cons of the internet, but I think that I've been more thankful for it during all this. It's allowed me to keep being in touch with my readers. And, you know, I was able to have a book tour that was all virtual. I'm able to see my students' faces because of the availability of programs online that allow us to do that. But also, you know, people just figuring out ways to see each other. You know, for instance, you know, I see a lot more people out on their porches visiting with people at 6 or 8 feet distance, you know, or out on the yard. People going for walks together, although they're distanced in their walk. I've certainly seen a lot more young people in my neighborhood outside during all this, riding their bicycles. I mean, almost like a return to the way it was when I was young. I think we have such a necessity during all this to be online, to do our work or to see each other, that it's caused us to seek out ways to not be online more often. Yeah, you know, I mean, I think a lot of people would sometimes spend their evenings on their laptops or on their phones, or now out going for walks and sitting on the porch. Yeah. So I'm glad to see that.
In addition to community, there are, you know, several themes that when I look at what you've written, things that I pick out, and of course that may say a lot about me as well as what you're trying to get across, but some that I see are ideas of risk and loss and acceptance and also faith. Mm-hmm. And all of these, to some degree, seem like they're central to what we're going through here in the pandemic. And I was wondering, as I was preparing for today, if you were writing fiction about this time, what would be at the top of that list for you in terms of things that you'd be interested in exploring?
Hmm. Well, in fact, I've been commissioned to write a play about the pandemic. That'll be part of a series at a theater that I'm proud to be able to work with. And so I've been thinking about all those things that you just mentioned. But, you know, one thing I've been thinking a lot about is how lucky I am to be in a healthy relationship. I can't imagine being stuck mm-hmm. with somebody through all this that I don't want to be with 24/7. And so my play is focusing on somebody who is with somebody, and they're being forced to be with them and they don't want to be. I have thought so much about people who are in bad relationships or have abusive parents or not being able to go to school or work or things like that. It doesn't allow the escape that they might have had in other ways, you know? So yeah. I think that's a really interesting angle to take on it. And it's something I've thought of. I think a lot of us, I hear a lot of people talk about how fortunate we feel. And so I think that's one thing that I'm definitely writing about right now.
The gratitude that maybe you didn't realize or didn't have before, perhaps.
Yeah, and you know, I've also thought about how much worse this could all be. I mean, it could be so much worse, and it has been so much worse. I mean, people have gone through far worse things than this. And so I think keeping that in mind is always helpful when you are going through a hard time.
Yeah, one of the things that has occurred to me looking at my students and my children is that the sort of uncertainty of the future, you know, in some ways it presents opportunities and can be exciting, but it's a lot of anxiety there.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that I've worried the most about is young people and how this is changing their lives. For instance, you know, my son just graduated from college in early May, and, you know, he graduated into a frozen world, a frozen job market, et cetera, you know, yeah. And so I just feel so badly. I remember when I was 22 years old, how much fun I was having. I was just yeah. going everywhere and seeing as many people as I, you know, just out with all kinds of people and traveling around. And he's just not able to do that in the same way.
Yeah. Let me ask a little bit about one other theme that's important, which is place. Now, this, of course, is famously important to Appalachian folks and everybody else. And, of course, it's a big part of your work and your history. I've spent the pandemic mostly in Lexington, and that certainly has been central to my experience of all of this. I wanted to ask how place has figured into it for you.
Well, you know, I lived in Appalachia all of my life until the last year. I moved to Lexington last year, and it has been a very different experience than it has been for my family down home in southeastern Kentucky. I think that being here in Lexington, I'm more aware of how many more people that I'm forced to be around when I'm at the grocery store, you know, and things like that. It's just a bigger population. But I also see it being handled in a very different way. I think where I'm from, there's a lot more aversion to wearing masks and to going by the guidelines, a lot more acceptance of the idea that, well, you know, something's going to kill you anyway. So, yeah. You know, So it's like, on one hand, I can admire that attitude of just embracing what has happened and going for it. But on the other hand, I see real endangerment of other people happening in that way. Now, that's not to say that people in the city don't do that, too. They certainly do. And, I mean, I see it every day. But it is just a real different approach, culturally, I think.
Yeah, and I was thinking, too, I lived for a while in Chicago, for instance, and to get out of town was a sort of an ordeal, or at least it took a fair amount of time. You know, Lexington is the kind of a place that really in 20 minutes you can be out in the countryside, and that has a I know for my family it's had a certain value.
Well, I know one thing that I've thought about a lot is if society completely collapses, I want to be in the country. I do not want to be in the city. And one reason is because I know how to survive in the country in a way that I don't know how to survive in the city. So I have thought about that. You know, I think the pandemic has made me think about things like that in a whole different way. It seems much more feasible.
Yeah, I know. Well, let's think about that for a second, the future. What do you see coming? And are there certain things that you're hopeful for, or maybe other things that you're fearful of or dread?
Well, yeah, I have read two or three novels that are set during the 1918 pandemic. And they have made me think a lot about how, you know, the world recovered from that. They got through it. They went forward. And we can too. And I think they had lots of the same issues back then of the flu, you know, lots of people not taking it seriously and endangering others by doing that and et cetera. The same thing happened then. But eventually, you know, it was overcome and went forward. So, I mean, I'm hopeful when it comes to the pandemic, I'm hopeful that it'll, you know, we will, the economy will recover and we'll return to being able to be with each other. Now, I don't want to say we'll return to normalcy, because I do think that this will change us in positive ways, too. I mean, I hope so. I think the people I know are certainly thinking more about how they want to spend their time more wisely, how they want to spend their time with other people that they love more often and not devote so much of it to work and things like that. So the thing about us as Americans, we have such short attention spans. You know, I don't know if we ever learn our lessons or not. So it's easy to say that right now. We'll see in, I don't know, 10 years, maybe we can revisit this conversation and see what happens.
One of the things that I've seen with a lot of people is that all of this has really, you know, forced an introspection or forced a reevaluation of a lot of things that we took for granted.
Exactly.
Are there some things that that you've reevaluated in the midst of all this?
Well, just what I was saying about I think that I have allowed myself to work too much sometimes. I think not being able to see my parents as often as I want to, and certainly not being able to hug them and, you know, sit closely to them and all that has made me much more aware of how fleeting time is and how we're all getting older. And so, I think because, I mean, I haven't touched my parents since all this happened because I want to protect them, mm-hmm. and I have not been within 6 feet of them. I have been able to see them, but we've been very careful. You know, they're in their mid to late 70s. And so I just, it's made me think a lot more about the day that I'll be able to hug them without fear.
Yeah. I've thought I'm in a similar situation and thought those same sorts of things.
That's what infuriates me when I see people who are just so, you know, blasé about it and just don't seem to mind that they're endangering others by refusing to step away or refusing to wear a mask, you know, et cetera. I just think it's selfish.
Yeah, and it's just going to cause us to have to deal with this for longer.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Silas, thank you so much for being here. This has been talking with Silas House, professor and chair of Appalachian Studies at Berea College and novelist. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Kentucky Derby weekend is just ahead, or just winding down if you're listening to us on Sunday evening. Kind of feels odd to be talking about the Derby in September, doesn't it? The Run for the Roses has been staged on the first Saturday in May, every year since 1946. Did you know horse racing looked a whole lot different back in its earliest days in Kentucky? To find out more about that, we put in a call to Dr. Gary Odell. He's professor of geography at Morehead State University, and author of At the Starting Post, Racing Venues and the Origins of Thoroughbred Racing in Kentucky, 1783 through 1865. It's published in the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society. You know drag racing? They used to do that, but with horses.
Well, you have to sort of understand the nature of the countryside in America. It was heavily forested, except for this sort of region around the bluegrass. And it was a lot of work to try to establish a long circular course when one had to cut down a bunch of trees. So the easiest solution was simply to find some area where you could race a couple of horses in a straight line. It didn't take a lot of room.
This was called quarter racing, first developed in Virginia.
Basically, they would take two horses, two men would have an opinion as to who had the faster horse, and they would pit them one against the other, and each man would ride his own horse. There were no jockeys at that time. And whoever won the race then would receive payment. Sometimes it might be the loser's horse. Sometimes it might be part of a crop. Tobacco is often a wager on these races.
One of Kentucky's first quarter racing paths was at Shallow Ford Station in Madison County, about 8 miles from Boonesboro. But in 1788, William Whitley of Lincoln County began putting two and two together and had this idea that would change the design of the Kentucky racetrack forever.
Through that part of Kentucky, there's a lot of hills, circular hills, not too terribly tall, that are known as knobs locally. And he had one such knob on his property that he thought would make a great race course, because establishing the course in a circle around the base of the hill, then people could stand on the hill and look down upon the race and have a perfect view of what was going on.
This was the 1780s. America had just fought a war for independence from Britain, and William Whitley did not like the English.
Even though he loved horse racing, he was determined that he was going to give it a strictly an American touch instead of following English custom. Now, at the time, the custom in England was to run horses around a track in a clockwise direction. So he simply turned it around in reverse and ran horses counterclockwise, and that custom has persisted to the present day. Now, there's also some other big changes that were made. Racing in England is over what are called courses, and we don't really have race courses in America. We have what are called race tracks. The English courses would kind of sort of wind and twist and go through the landscape in and out of trees, and didn't really have a specific plan to them, except they would come back to the starting point. And quite often the action would go out of sight of the spectators. Here in America, we established oval courses. The racing would be visible for spectators during the entire race. Another thing that was done was that we liked to have what are called skinned tracks. In England, they raced on grass. But here in America, we chose to take the sod off and race on dirt because people thought it was a lot faster. Now, one last major change was that in England, the whole object of a horse race was simply to see who had the faster horse. Now, here in America, we had these oval courses set out at standard lengths, generally about a mile, and this allowed us timekeeping to be made. In other words, they could take a stopwatch and they could time how fast the horse went around the course and could judge different horses based on their relative speeds. the English were pretty much baffled by this whole tendency of Americans to put so much emphasis on timing, because all that really mattered to them was which horse won the race, not how fast they ran it.
Things were still pretty wild and woolly back in the late 18th century, so wild, so woolly, that in the fall of 1793, a public meeting was called in Lexington to address the dangers and inconveniences of allowing horse racing through streets in town.
In Lexington, these were generally done on the town commons. That was an open area that paralleled the town Branch Creek and is today Vine Street. And that was pretty popular for these quarter races. But the town trustees thought that these kind of races were hazardous to the population and pretty much a public nuisance. But unfortunately, this practice was so popular, they didn't really feel like they could impose an outright ban. So they called a town meeting to discuss this issue. The results of that meeting were not actually recorded anywhere, but it wasn't long afterward, just a few months, that the state government stepped in. They banned street racing in Lexington and a couple of other bluegrass communities, and then they expanded the act that they had passed to apply it to several other communities, and then finally got tired of the whole approach and decided to make a universal ban to all communities in Kentucky. So street racing was no longer allowed, and in respect to public sensitivities, they also banned the mating of horses except in covered lots.
That had been going on in the streets too, correct?
Sure. They were showing stud horses right out in public, and, you know, crowds would gather around and interfere with movement in the streets. And, of course, I'm sure that witnessing mating horses was not approved of by a number of people, you know, and so the legislation did away with that. Now, the whole outcome of this ban on street racing was to provide further incentive for establishing these racing courses that would be just outside the town bounds and would provide a venue for hosting these races.
Races like the Derby at Churchill Downs in Louisville and the upcoming fall meet at Keeneland in Lexington. Dr. Gary Odell, author of At the Starting Post, Racing Venues and the Origins of Thoroughbred Racing in Kentucky, 1783 through 1865. You can find that article in the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society. It's online at history.ky.gov. That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org. On the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We do like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.